Welcome to Lectionary at Lunch. Today the Old Testament lesson is Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 15. Since this is a long text, I'm going to skip reading the Hebrew and also limit my comments fairly strenuously. I'll try to translate in a pretty wooden way so you'll be able to follow along with the Hebrew text reasonably well. Let me just say one thing about the context before we begin. And that is that this is really, in some ways, the beginning of the book of Exodus, in terms of the first narrative arc of the book. The first two chapters are introductory material, setting the scene and introducing the main characters. And now the primary narrative begins with the encounter between Moses and God on Mount Sinai. So beginning with chapter 3, verse 1. Moses was shepherding, and no participle and verb of form to be there, the flock of Jethro, now a positive, his father-in-law. Choton is anyone related by marriage, actually. But now another a positive, a priest of Midian. And he guided the flock. Now this phrase, Achar Hamidbar, is often commented upon by commentator writers, sometimes translated merely beyond the wilderness, other times to the west of the wilderness. Either translation is grammatically defensible and doesn't affect the main meaning of the text, but is often debated in terms of the relation of where Mount Sinai is and where Midian is located and so forth. So he shepherded them, we'll translate, to the west of the wilderness or beyond the wilderness, either one. And he came to the mountain of God, to Horeb. Note the hey directive on the end of Horeb there. Another appositive to El Har, Elohim, and then the appositive Horeb. Verse 2. The messenger of Yahweh appeared to him in a tongue of fire in the midst of the bush. Definite article there, the bush. And he saw, and wow, or something like that here, behold is probably the traditional translation, but it's a little dry here. Holy cow, the bush was burning with fire, and now an adversative wow, but the bush, there was not to it. And now this last word in verse 2 is probably the most problematic form in our text. Ukal is clearly pointed as a pu'al perfect third masculine singular, but that makes no grammatical sense at all in the context. And so it's usually taken to be either a mispointed, that is to say the pointing being reversed, call passive participle, which should be akul instead of ukal, really the pointing inverted, or alternately, sometimes suggested that it's a call perfect, a remnant of the old call passive perfect form that has become misconstrued by the Masoretes. But anyway, it clearly has to be translated, but as for the bush, it was not burning. Maybe some have also suggested that it really should be a pu'al participle and the initial mame has simply fallen off. It would be mu'kal. So that's another possibility, although we'll never know, I don't suppose. Verse 3. And Moses said, and here we have a cohortative, Asurana. Most traditionally we translate the cohortative something like, let me turn aside. But here, this is a good example of a cohortative where the speaker is not asking permission to do something. He's simply expressing what's on his mind. So his intention or will or desire. So we probably translate something like Moses said, I think I'll turn aside and look at this great sight. And now another appositive, Madua, starting with Madua, and this great sight is namely, why the bush is not burning. Verse 4. And Yahweh saw that he had turned aside to look, and he called to him, that is God, God called to him from the midst of the bush, and he said, Moses, Moses, and Moses said, huh? Again, the traditional translation, something like, here I am, That's a good translation if you're thinking in terms of behold me etymologically. But this word is, if we think in terms of function, the function of this word in the language when used like this is simply to, this is simply what you say when somebody speaks to you. It's the way you respond. And so if we were translating colloquially, you know, how do you respond when somebody speaks to you in modern English? You say, what? Huh? Yeah? And so we probably wouldn't actually translate it that way in church. It's maybe a little too informal for ecclesiastical use. But that's what Moses is saying. He's saying, huh? What? Verse 5. And he, namely God, said, do not approach or do not draw near hither to this place. Now, an imperative, shall, from nashal, take off your sandals from upon your feet, because the place which you are standing upon it, literally ground of holiness here, construct used adjectivally, holy ground is it. Verse 6, and he said, I am the God of your father, singular. Usually we counter this phrase, it's God of your fathers, plural. That would be avotheka in Hebrew, not just a difference in pointing. Commentators debate the significance of this. Some say no significance. Others argue that the point here that God is making is that he's the God of Moses' biological father, not of his ancestors, but specifically of his father, his Hebrew father in Egypt. But in any case, it is singular, and it's rare that it's singular. Normally, this phrase is plural. So I am the God of your father, and then after that, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Some people will amend that God of your father singular to make it plural. But again, that's not simply repointing. That's having to substitute a couple of letters that would have fallen out. And then carrying on the last part of verse 6, and Moses hid his face, yaster, he hid his face, because, here the key introduces an explanatory clause, because he was afraid. And now this last phrase is a little bit cumbersome for many people. Min habit, we have here an infinitive construct, hifil, from the root nabat, with a men on the front, indicating separation. In this case, separation giving the reason he was afraid, as we would say in English, he was afraid of looking upon God, or looking to God. Literally, the Hebrew says he was afraid from to look to God, but we would translate afraid of looking or afraid to look. Verse 7, and Yahweh said, and here an infinitive absolute followed by a perfect, ra'ah, ra'ithi. Yahweh said, I have surely seen, or certainly seen, the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and their outcry, tzakatham, their outcry I have heard. And here this mithne, literally from the face of their oppressors, from the face of here is used colloquially, meaning something like on account of or because of, indicating the agent, you see. So we probably translate, I've heard their oppression because of their oppressors, or from their oppressors, perhaps. And then this last key, you could translate it as an explanatory key, because I know their sufferings. Some people take this as an example of an emphatic key. Indeed, I know their sufferings. The extent of the use of the emphatic key in Hebrew is highly debated, and we won't pause to debate it here, but at least it's a place where one might. The emphatic key is clearly used in oath formulas. Its use outside of oath formulas is debated, and here this is a possible example of one. Anyway, God continues in verse 8 his speech, and I have come down to deliver from the hand of Egypt, him collectively, referring to the people. I've come down to deliver him from the hand of Egypt, and to bring him up from that land, Eretz Ha'i, to the land, or to a land Tovah Rahava, wide and good and wide, to a land flowing with respect to milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. I'll ask, we don't have time to go into detail about all those people groups. This list is pretty standard. It varies from various places in the Pentateuch, and not always the same list. The Girgashites are omitted here, for example. They're commonly included. The next verse begins with the form Wa'atah, and now. And atah here is probably not used in the normal or more common temporal sense. It's probably used as a discourse marker here to indicate the point that this argument is coming to. Now, you said this, and what's the point, you see? The point is, behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me, and also I have seen their oppression, the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them, I guess we translate. And now, Lachu, come on, I am sending you, or I will send you, to Pharaoh. And now we have another somewhat problematic form. The text, form in the text as it stands is a imperative, hotse. That doesn't quite make good grammatical sense. And so, if you look at the textual apparatus, you'll see that the Samaritan Pentateuch, the Septuagint, and the Vulgate translate this as a second person perfect form. And it appears that what's happened is the eth, following the direct object marker eth, has either been separated and the aleph duplicated, in other words, the form should be la-hutsa-atha, the aleph and tau have been separated wrongly from the preceding word, and the aleph duplicated, or alternately, the tau has fallen off. Now, the first tau has fallen off. You should have hey, wow, sade, aleph tau, and so on. So the doubled aleph tau, the second tau, may have fallen off here. A second person perfect form, while consecutive perfect, makes a great deal of sense in this context. Go with the result that you will bring my people, the sons of Israel, from Egypt. Verse 11, and Moses said to God, who am I? And I translate this verb, a lake, as a modal imperfect, sort of like the subjunctive. Remember, Hebrew doesn't have a separate subjunctive. The imperfect does double duty for those forms. So Moses said to God, who am I that I should, or that I could, go to Pharaoh, and that I could or should bring out the sons of Israel from Egypt. And then verse 12, God responds. And by the way, here verse 12 begins simply, Wayomer, he said, to avoid confusion about who's speaking, the Septuagint and some of the other texts clarify by adding some additional words. So the Septuagint says, and God said to Moses, pretty clearly a secondary addition for the sake of clarifying the Wayomer and Wayomer here in the conversation. So in any case, God said, I will be with you. And this to you is the sign that I have sent you. Here a temporal base on an infinitive construct. In your bringing up means when you have brought up the people from Egypt, you will serve God upon this mountain. Now, the one question in the interpretation of this text is, what's the sign? Is the sign that the fact that God is with them, or is the sign the fact that that they'll worship on the mountain once they come out of Egypt? I think grammatically and also in the context, the latter is the better choice. The sign is that when they've been brought out, they'll worship here on the mountain. But there aren't. That's not without some debatable points, but we'll pass it over for the moment. Verse 13, now Moses speaking again. Moses said to God, behold, I am ba. Now this ba could be a perfect third masculine singular, or it could be a participle masculine singular. In the context, since it's paired with anoki, it really While it morphologically can be a third masculine singular, in terms of its use, it doesn't make much sense. So almost certainly a participle masculine singular here. Behold, I probably mistranslated there. This hine should probably not be translated behold, even though that is, of course, a common use of hine. This is probably a secondary use of hine to introduce a conditional sentence in the context. So we're probably better off translating it if. God said to Moses, if I go to the sons of Israel, and if I say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and if they say to me, what is his name? And then we'll have to supply, then what shall I say to them? You see, Moses is here posing a hypothetical situation. And hine is used to introduce those kinds of sentences. It's just not its most common use. And most of us would stumble over that, as I did there, just reading along in the hine, we sort of instinctively translate it the other way. But here's a clear-cut example of hine introducing a conditional sentence. Verse 14, God responds. God said to Moses, I will be who I will be. I'll come back in a second and defend that. And he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I will be has sent me to you. Now, why did I translate this as future instead of the more common I am who I am? Two reasons. First reason is the imperfect of the verb to be in Hebrew is first person imperfect like this is never used in Hebrew to communicate a present tense. It's always used to communicate a future tense. If you look at all of its uses in the Old Testament, you'll find that to be true. There's one possible exception where in one instance it's paired with an adjective that could be understood as present. But the far and away the most common use is as future. The second reason has to do with what's happening here in this text. There are several times in the book of Exodus when Moses tries to get one up on God, to get God to sort of tell him something God hasn't intended to tell him, or show him something that God hasn't intended to show him. And in each of these cases, God responds in the sort of way that preserves his freedom. Is what in Lutheran theology we might call a pointer to the Deus absconditus, the hiddenness of God. In each one of the instances where you have this kind of encounter, God responds in the same way, either giving Moses a partial answer or saying something like, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion, or later when Moses says, show me your glory, God says, I'll show you my goodness, not my glory. Moses is constantly pressing God for a fuller revelation than God intends to give him. And God always responds to Moses in the book of Exodus with this sort of Deus absconditus answer that preserves divine freedom. In the context of ancient Near Eastern religion, to know the name of a God is to have power over that God, at least to be able to influence that God in the use of magic by invoking the name. And this is especially true in Egyptian context. There's a very famous Egyptian mythological account of that makes this point very specifically with the revelation of the secret name of the Eye of Horus. Coming particularly from an Egyptian context, perhaps God is sensitive to Moses' inclination to think that if he knows the name of God, he can control him or at least manage him or in some way. And so that often, I think, ties into this preservation of God's freedom in the book of Exodus. So I think both on grammatical grounds and on sort of theological and contextual grounds within the book of Exodus, I'm right. And the tradition of translating this as a present tense is wrong here. But you can make up your own mind on that score. Verse 15. We'll comment on this, but let's go ahead and translate. God said again, oath, or further, more, God said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel. Now here we have two choices. We can translate this next phrase either as a verbless identification clause, in which case we would translate, Yahweh is the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, period. He has sent me to you. Or we can translate it as an appositive, Yahweh, comma, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and God of Jacob. I suppose it doesn't make a huge difference in terms of meaning. I happen to prefer the first, seeing this as a verbal identification clause, again, largely on the basis of parallel to other similar instances where God speaks to Moses and speaks about his identity, where these verbalist identification clauses are used in all the other contexts. So it doesn't make a huge difference with regard to meaning. The real point is what follows in the last phrase, namely, he's to say to them, Yahweh has sent me to you. This is my name forever. This is Zikri, literally my memorial, that is the thing by which I'm to be remembered, Lador Dor, to the last generation. If we were back in the 80s, we'd probably translate Zikri with this is my handle, like my CB handle. You know, today maybe this is my screen name or something like that. This is the way you're going to remember me and talk about me is the point. This is online name, or in this case, is on earth name. Notice here in the just one last comment before we wrap up. In this passage, most commentators get off base, or most preachers get off base, most readers get off base by focusing on the revelation of the divine name in verse 14. In this text, which is part of a broader dialogue that goes to chapter 4, verse 17, God appears to Moses and tells Moses what he wants to tell him. And then Moses gives four objections, and God responds to those four objections. This is in the objection. It's the second of Moses' objections in the context. This is not what God appeared for the purpose of telling Moses. This is a subsidiary point that Moses raised. The main point in the text is that God has, what God said earlier, namely, I've seen the suffering of your my people, I'm sending you to do something about it. And when God actually identifies himself to Moses at the beginning of the text, it's not as Yahweh, but as the God of your fathers. This is passage ties closely into the passage at the beginning of Exodus 6, where there the focus is on the revelation of the name Yahweh, but it's not either there nor here is the name Yahweh to be understood merely in terms of its etymology. That is, what's its grammatical form? What word does it come from? Does it mean I am in the sense that I exist, or I'm caused to be? In both texts, the name is described and defined in terms of its function, which is also the case in Exodus 15, the poem in Exodus 15. Yahweh is identified in terms of what he does, namely his redemptive function. So if you ask the question, what's the meaning of the name Yahweh? The meaning of the name Yahweh, both in this text in chapter 6 and in chapter 15, is Yahweh is the one, Yahweh, the name Yahweh is associated with God's redemptive activity. Namely, his redeeming Israel out of Egypt. And that's what we ought to emphasize if we talk about the revelation of the name at all in conjunction with this text. Otherwise, the main point in the text is the revelation of God's redemptive purpose. And that wraps up our look at Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 15 for today. Thank you.